My name is Neil Kulkarni, and you're listening to Excel Podcasts, the perfect career exploration podcast for any student out there.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Excel Podcasts. In episode 38, I'm sitting down with another inspirational young changemaker, Aga Haider. Aga is a rising freshman at Emory University and the CEO and founder of numerous nonprofit organizations such as the Literacy Initiative, the Education Collaborative, Next Young Leaders Program, all of which have even made him a conversationalist, education honoree, alongside other amazing young changemakers. Aga and I talk so much about education, entrepreneurship, building a nonprofit, and more about his unique journey that you will be able to hear about right after our quick message about Anchor.
Before we dive into the specifics of your journey, your past, would you just mind giving a quick introduction about yourself, maybe a brief introduction about your past initiatives, and just what you believe defines your persona?
Absolutely. So yeah, once again, my name is Aga Haider. I just graduated high school not too long ago, just a couple weeks ago, and I'm currently a rising college freshman at Emory University. I founded the Literacy Initiative, so that's my first project, during my eighth grade year in middle school. And at the time, we really focused on providing books to students across the St. Louis area. But as I grew and became more mature and learned a lot more through my peers and in the classroom, I realized that I wanted to take the organization further. And that's how we developed our Books and Cookies after school program, which was our main program for quite a while until, of course, COVID-19 hit and we had to shut down our in-person programs. Luckily, we were able to have a super strong team who was flexible, and we were able to develop our first virtual camp program, which brought in over 1,000 students from across the world. And that was just a really cool program where we were truly able to see the impact that we were able to make in such a time of uncertainty. And now this past year, I started a new project called the Education Collaborative, which is really just focused on breaking down socioeconomic barriers in education, whether that be education inside the classroom or even outside the classroom as well. So yeah, that's kind of what I've worked on throughout my high school. Of course, I've been involved in a multitude of different other activities inside and outside of my high school. But one thing that I would say defines my persona specifically is that whenever I see an issue or I'm doing a research paper, some sort of presentation, and I see an issue that is really impactful to me, I don't just stand around and just do that research, give it to the class, or present it to the class. I also take action on it as much as I can and in whatever way I can. So that's really the main thing that I would say defines my persona. Is I'm someone who's a go-getter and will always take action, never really be that person who stands by. And I think that's really what's made me successful in both of these past initiatives that I've worked on.
You started this at a relatively young age, right? I think middle school, a lot of us are still sort of trying to figure their way out. I'd love to just hear more about your vision when you were initially just thinking about these projects.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really great question. Yeah, I know a lot of times students aren't really thinking about, oh, I'm going to start my own nonprofit or organization in middle school, but really throughout my middle school career, I was able to be more exposed to a lot more of the issues that surround the St. Louis community, so where I was born and raised. And actually, I started how all my service work got started. It really started when my parents exposed me to a lot of different volunteer and service events when I was really young. So around 10 years old was when I started going to different events and helping volunteer, for example, the Down Syndrome Association of Greater St. Louis, Operation Clean Stream, and a few other organizations. I had volunteered with them throughout my early elementary school years. And then after that, it was during the summer and going into my eighth grade year where I actually broke my leg while I was at my friend's house. And what happened was I couldn't do much that summer, of course, because I was in a cast from my foot all the way up to my thigh, and I really couldn't do anything. And so I was binge watching TV for the majority of the summer and came across a TV show called The Halo Effect, in which it was a show that was focused on highlighting individuals who are making an outstanding impact in their community. And what was really cool about it was the fact that it was young individuals who had stepping up to take action in their own community. And so I actually got in contact with the head of the Little St. Nick Foundation to start up a chapter of their organization in St. Louis. And so I ended up doing that for quite a while, for multiple years, actually. And then I decided to pivot to the literacy initiative after I gave a talk in front of my eighth grade English class for just discussing illiteracy among children and teens in poverty. Because of the fact that I had been such an avid reader throughout my elementary school years and even before that, I really realized the fact that there were so many kids out there who didn't have the same educational opportunities and resources that I had growing up, especially with reading and literacy. And so that really impacted me in middle school. And those were the times where I was actually getting more exposed to some of these issues through the classroom and just from the research I was doing. And so I realized the importance of not only just speaking on this issue, but actually taking action on the issue. And I had always been someone who was social, outgoing, and wanted to make a change. And that's how I went about starting the Literacy Initiative. And I think also I had a lot of support from my friends and peers. They really thought the idea was really cool and really wanted me to pursue and follow through with it after I kind of told them my plans and vision. And so I was also with the support of friends, family, and all of those folks who provided me with that stepping stone to start up the Literacy Initiative. And then I think a lot of my experiences that I worked on throughout my organization really led me to continue working on it, even as times did get stressful throughout high school, and then eventually founding the Education Collaborative this past year.
Yeah, man. I mean, I just love how you took something negative. I mean, it sucks that you had that injury, but you're helping out so many kids. You're impacting communities. You're impacting families. I think that's one of the main things that a lot of people don't realize is that by helping a kid read, you're educating the kid. And you're not just helping the kid, but you're helping the family. And that's having a very long-term effect that some kids, bystanders who just see your impact from the outside, they'll start to notice the effects when all those kids begin to go on and do great things. And I think another big thing about the work you're doing is that it doesn't just combine the basic fundamentals of a nonprofit organization, but also entrepreneurship, education, business, sort of all these aspects that are working together to create the literacy initiative, to create the education collaborative. So to kind of move into that, I think one of the big things that I wanted to talk about was misconceptions. So in terms of your experiences, what do you believe are some common misconceptions which can lead individuals down the wrong path when they're trying to start something of their own in this space like you have?
Yeah, absolutely. That's another great question. I think there's a couple different ways to tackle this question. And so I'll tackle it from a couple different perspectives. But first and foremost, I think it's a common misconception that I think this is getting a lot better now as far as what I've been able to see from other people's work. But I think oftentimes there's a common misconception that you have to be a certain age to make an impact. But I actually think that there's really no age or no specific age that you have to be to make an impact in your community. A lot of people might say that when they're 13 years old, that, what can I do? I'm only 13, and make those excuses. But in reality, there are students out there or teens out there that are making an impact at 13 years old, whether it be even just volunteering at a local food pantry. It doesn't have to be you're changing the world at 13 years old. But I think that can often be a common misconception that oh, what can I do? I'm only 12 or 13. Whereas you can actually truly make an impact when you are young. And I think at times it even makes more of an impact when you do something at a young age, because then other teens or other kids will be inspired by your story and your work. And then they will take action in their own community because they see that, oh, there's another kid that's doing something that's making a positive impact in my school or local community. I want to make that same impact, or I want to do something else. And they'll get involved, and it'll really be this chain reaction. And also another uncommon misconception is the fact that, oh, I can just start this up and, or just start up an organization and, oh, everything will run well. But the reality of it is there's going to be a lot of road bumps that you're going to hit. And you have to be passionate about solving these issues in order to succeed. Because if you don't have that passion, you're honestly, you're not going to run your organization for more than maybe a few weeks, or even maybe you'll make it to a year, but you won't truly love what you're doing because it is a lot of work. And there's a lot of late nights where you're going to be staying up playing in an event, or you're going to be coordinating stuff with volunteers. There will be a lot of those late nights. And a lot of no's, you'll receive a ton of the answer no throughout your entire journey throughout the nonprofit space. Because of course, there are so many nonprofits out there and not everybody can support, or not everybody can volunteer. So there will be a lot of times where you just don't receive a response, or you'll receive the response no. And that has honestly been something in the beginning that it was hard to deal with, all these no's or these negative responses. But it was really what I found that was the fact that whenever I did receive those yes responses, it made a huge difference and it was a pretty big thing. So I would say passion is such a huge component of it, because if you're passionate about a certain issue, you will absolutely take that initiative and stick with it. And I think education is such a huge thing that's been a part of my life, and it's something that I'm passionate about, making sure that every student has access to education and equitable, and creating a more equitable education system is something that I'm incredibly passionate about and has allowed me to continue all of that work through service.
A lot of starting your own organization, even if it's not in education, even if it's in sports, you can't do it by yourself. How would you go about networking, just building genuine relationships? As I always think of the phrase, it's who you know, not what you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think networking and just truly building genuine relationships is such a critical part of running an organization, or running a successful organization, I might say, especially in today's day and age. Networking was something that I've really worked on throughout my journey in the nonprofit space, especially just because of the fact that without networking and reaching out to people, you truly can't be successful, or in most cases, you won't be successful. And that kind of goes into what I said before about the fact that you will receive a ton of answers that will be no, or you just may not receive responses from people. But it's really those schools. For me specifically, with my nonprofit, we work the majority of kind of places we work with are schools and nonprofit organizations that support youth. And really those schools that are interested in bringing their program into your school, that's already making a networking opportunity, making a network with a principal or a librarian, and truly expanding your network through there. And they'll also help you in the future as well, reaching out to other schools or providing testimonies of how we impacted their school or worked with their school. And something that's really interesting, and whenever I tell people this, they're always intrigued by it, but the way I went about getting our volunteer team was I actually direct messaged people on Instagram, like friends, mutual followers, stuff like that. And we slowly, word started spreading about this organization. People would tell their friends, they would add their friends, or they would post this opportunity, for example, in their group chats and stuff like that, because of the fact that they would be able to truly see that sort of connection where they could see my message, but also look at my profile, see the things that I've worked on, and see the fact that I was trying to make an impact in my community. And then they would want to get involved. They would be more excited about it. Whereas, for example, if I sent them an email, they wouldn't really be able to see much about myself and what I had been doing or had been working on. Whereas through Instagram, it's more of an opportunity to showcase yourself and show the fact that you've been making an impact and working on different projects throughout your high school career. So that's how we've gotten almost, I've worked with almost 700 or 750 students, all high school volunteers, and almost all of them have been connected to me or I've connected with them through Instagram. I mean, that's one of the things that's truly incredible at the power of social media, because of course there are a lot of people that say, oh, social media is bad. And yes, it is in quite a few different ways, but at the same time, it's also a way to truly make change and bring people together for a good cause is by connecting with people on various platforms. And so that's one of the ways that I've networked. And then also, you also mentioned building genuine relationships. That's also so important, because it's not, they're not just a volunteer when they're working. Especially if you're a high school student and, you know, you're working with other high school students, they're not just a volunteer, but they're actually going to be your friends. They're going to be the people you go to for other things as well, outside of just volunteering. They're going to be the people who maybe like you go to their games, for example, or you support them at whatever other endeavors they do. It's not just the fact that, oh, they volunteer for your organization, that's it, you don't ever see them again, but rather it's really truly building those genuine connections and being truly friends with them, because of course they're people too, and they're also high school students that are going through their own sort of thing. And so you also want to make sure you're there to support them and also just be friends with them as well.
I especially agree with you on that social media aspect, right? I think during this pandemic, social media has been highlighted a lot, right? I think one of the main sources is through Netflix. I'm forgetting the name. I think it was, yeah, The Social Dilemma, that documentary that highlighted mainly the negatives of social media. But I think it's all about channeling that positivity of social media, using it to reach out to like-minded people and starting small, reaching out to people that you know that you can have a conversation with, you can learn from, and then just working your way from there, just making those small baby steps that in the long run will pay off, whether you know it now or whether you know it a month later. But just sort of diving into more of the educational sector before we wrap up, we're both high school seniors going into college soon. And I think it's definitely been a weird experience learning virtually. I can say on my end, there's definitely been some obstacles, like all the virtual meetings, how you had to be really safe about meeting in person if you had no other choice to. But I really wanted to talk about what you believe COVID-19 has brought to light in education. What aspect of education you believe like needs change. I think in terms of my experiences, I think it's really shown to me that like a lot more about the motivation of a student, what really a student has to push through to actually learn the content rather than just go for the grade, just go for the result.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great question and something that's really important as well. I think the COVID-19 has definitely exposed the inequities within the education system, just because of the fact that when you saw schools transitioning quickly from that in-person to virtual virtual classes, it was apparent that school districts and private schools and just wealthier communities were truly able to make the transition a lot more quickly and a lot more seamlessly. Whereas a lot of the school districts that are in low-income neighborhoods, they have to deal with other issues, such as how are students going to get their free meals when they're not going to be at school? Like, how are they supposed to be able to still have those interactions? Will they have computers at home, or do they have a phone or even Wi-Fi that they can connect to join their Zoom classes? And so I did a podcast about this with my friend in April or May of 2020, when COVID was really rampant and schools were truly making that transition. And we interviewed schools that were in much better communities. And then we also interviewed schools that were in a lot of lower income areas. And so what we ended up seeing was the fact that the schools in low income neighborhoods, they were dealing with a lot more issues and a lot more obstacles than schools in more affluent communities, because of the fact that, again, they had to deal with students making sure that students had access to internet or had access to a computer, and also that students weren't going hungry. Because of course, if students don't have food at home, or if they don't have access to food or clean water, of course they're not going to perform as well in school, because they'll be thinking about when their next meal will come from, whereas students who are from more affluent backgrounds won't have to deal with those same issues. And so a lot of students also really see school as their safe haven and a place where they can truly just be themselves and escape from whatever they're going through at home or even in their own local community. And because of that transition to the virtual environment with Zoom and Google Meet and all that, we really saw the fact that a lot of students didn't have that school, same school, like safe haven, where they could go to a teacher if they needed help or support, whereas they would have to email them or meet with them virtually now because of COVID. And also at the same time, we've seen that a lot of schools in more affluent neighborhoods have gone to school in person, or more of a hybrid format, because they are able to make those steps and ensure that students will still be safe because they have more money and they'll be able to invest a lot more into different ways to just keep their students safe and healthy when they're at school. And also at the same time, if a student does get sick or a student comes or gets COVID, for example, then they oftentimes, if they're from more affluent districts or they go to a private school, they'll have that money to make sure that they can get the treatment that they need or to make sure that they can get medicine. Whereas if schools were to open in low-income neighborhoods and there were to be a COVID outbreak, there might be a lot of families who may not even have insurance or to cover anything regarding medical purposes and stuff like that. So I'm kind of rambling at this point, but I do believe that, once again, highlighting the fact that COVID has brought a lot of, really just exposed, once again, the inequities within the education system, the fact that there's so much work that still needs to be done. At the same time, it takes a village, truly, to make change and truly make an impact. And the fact that in Missouri, Governor Mike Parsons, I think, he was the one who announced at the beginning of the pandemic that because of COVID, of course, there were a lot new expenses and stuff like that that came about, but he decided that they were going to cut a lot of the education funding. And if anything, I think that funding should have come from other departments, not education, because of the fact that in the pandemic, education is so incredibly important. And also at the same time, supporting K through 12 schools, it also supports other programming that students may need outside of school as well. So I think if anything needs to change, it's the fact that the government needs to put a lot more focus on reinvesting a lot more money into education. And in times of crises and global pandemics, they need to not take that funding away from schools, but rather even invest more funds, regardless of where that may come from.
And that about does it for this week's episode of XL Podcast. As always, thank you so much for listening to episode 3 of season 3. Don't hesitate to reach out to us if you have any questions or suggestions. Stay active on all our platforms, Instagram, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Anchor. And just continue to stay active on this journey of learning with us. This is XL Podcast, signing off.